Welcome to Henny and Hallie Can't Quit Golf.
I'm Hallie. Can't quit.
Can't quit. What? I start over?
No.
You got it. Oh, man.
I mean, is it psycho or is it just great planning?
I'm like, why are we out here? because they love the game.
No.
I do not want to hit a little white golf ball around. Thank you guys so much for joining us. We are so excited to be doing this podcast, and we have an absolute awesome conversation to share with you today with Danielle Kang, LPGA Tour major winner. Such an awesome person, super spicy, full of life. And you know, we had a super interesting conversation, and I'm really excited to get into it a little bit. First, Henny, I want to talk to you about being a child phenom, because I talked to Danielle a little bit about that, and you were one as well, a very, very good golfer at a young age. I sucked. So how was being really good at golf at a young age?
Yeah, thanks for that intro. That's actually something that my husband says to wind me up. He calls me a phenom or a prodigy. I definitely don't feel that way, but I guess statistically speaking, probably.
I guess,
you know, you said it, I'll run with it. I played in my first professional golf event at the age of 13, was the youngest ever, which was crazy. And I remember just being completely in awe of all of the players I idolized, like Paola Marti and Laura Davis, Sophie Gustafson. And I was like, oh my God, am I playing alongside these people? This is wild. But I absolutely loved it, really enjoyed the experience. And I kept playing in tour events throughout my teens. I don't think I played at 14, but then like 15, 16, 17, 18, and all the way up until I turned pro at 18. And yeah, I feel like at that time, I'm going to blame our good friend Michelle for the young female prodigies at the time, because she was the original one. And she obviously came out with a bang when she was like 12, 13, nearly made a cut in the men's Sony Hawaiian Open, which is mind-boggling to me.
This is Michelle Wee West, if anybody is wondering who Michelle is. But yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Michelle.
Yeah, I had like newspaper articles and media to do, media training from the age of like 12, 13. And I was involved in Team Faldo alongside like Rory McIlroy and Mel Reid and Ollie Fisher. And that was Nick Faldo from his junior series, had a team of like 10 players. And in that we had media training, and along with being in that team came a lot more media scrutiny. So I guess you're always like under the spotlight, and there was always that pressure whenever I did tee up in a professional event or a major amateur event, you know, knowing that I had to speak to media afterwards and had having to answer for my performances from a very young age.
Yeah.
I guess for me that was just normal at the time, and then when I turned professional it just was a whole nother level, because I had this whole amateur career that now I was expected to immediately turn into professional results. And I didn't do that straight away. And I, you know, was probably one of the players that took a while to find their feet out there, and wasn't that big a fan of traveling, and really struggled to kind of handle that. Because as well as, you know, me trying to find my feet and not perform, I then also had to think about the perception of not performing and not living up to what my amateur career expectations were. So I eventually did find my feet, and I eventually became more comfortable with that and started to get some results. But it took me, a few years. It wasn't until I was like 21. So yeah, like 3 years of playing professional golf until I felt comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of pressure for young people. I mean, the pressure aspect hasn't changed over the years. And the expectation that you as a young person put on yourself is a lot. And it was actually interesting, oftentimes when players who are, you know, flew a little more under the radar, they were the ones that in fact came up and did better, because they didn't have as much of a weight on their shoulders.
Right.
But then at the same time, you know, it was really interesting for me and great experiences. And I am not saying like, you know, oh, it's all terrible and it was too much pressure and I struggled with it and whatnot. I mean, it was what it was. And
oh, sorry, I was going to say, when you said that felt normal for you when you were 15, 16 playing in professional events, did you know though that wasn't normal for the majority of other 15, 16 year olds?
I think I knew that it wasn't normal within England, but at the time there was so much spotlight on other 15, 16 year olds around the world that I felt like I had to keep up with them. So I remember on my radar was Michelle Wee, was Ashley Simon from South Africa. There were a couple other players and I just around the world, and I had my sights set on them as my benchmark. And I actually felt like I was behind. I felt like I wasn't doing that great if I wasn't, you know, nearly winning or finishing top 10 in these professional events at age 15, 16.
That's so much pressure. That's a lot. And here I was being like, if I broke 78, I was like, yes.
Yeah, I just didn't know any other way. You know, that was just like my sights were laser focused on that. And I just went for it. And I missed out on a ton. Like, I didn't drink alcohol until I was like 25. I never went to any of the parties, never really hung out with my friends, missed out on so much family stuff because I was always traveling from a really young age, from like 13, 14, even if it wasn't professional events, it was international amateur events. You know, I feel like I've been working since I was like 13.
Well, you have. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think my relationship with golf is like, you know, up and down, because sometimes I'm like, I feel like I've been grinding since I was 13. I just need a break. I don't want to go and play golf for fun. That is not fun.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's definitely a different relationship with golf than most people have, for sure. And I think whether it's Michelle Wee West, who in a similar situation, or as you'll find out, Danielle King, also very successful at a young age, winning the US amateur, playing in all four, at the time, four majors in the year as an amateur. It's a lot of pressure. It's a lot of pressure. And, you know, some people make it big and some people, you know, have nothing to do with golf for the rest of their lives because they're burnt out. And some people like yourself, you know, pivot into a very successful career doing something in the industry. And I think Danielle was one that continued to play, but not without her fair share of struggles. Something that her and I talked a lot about was mental health, a topic that she's very passionate about. And I know we talked in our first episode about authenticity. Danielle has been very open about her struggles with mental health, which I admire her courage for doing so a ton, because people can be very judgy. And I think the visibility when it comes to struggles with mental health is so important. Like, for someone like myself, I struggle with OCD and anxiety. But when you see somebody like Danielle King, who's obviously incredibly successful, and for myself, even to have this conversation that we're going to listen to in a minute here about how when she just accepted that anxiety was something that she has and she's going to have it for her whole life, that it was almost freeing in a way, because there is no quote unquote cure for anxiety. You just learn how to deal with it, and you learn, you know, you have different things in your quote unquote toolbox, and you learn to manage it, and it's just part of you, and that's okay. And you can still be incredibly successful, as, you know, Danielle is.
All right. Let's hear from the main woman herself, the fierce, the badass Danielle Kang, who you got the pleasure of catching up with.
Danielle Kang, welcome to the podcast.
Hi. I know Henny is so sad that she can't be here. So unfortunately, you just have me. I'm very, very sorry.
It's okay. But Holly, it's totally okay.
I'm very sorry. Next time we have you on, we'll get Henny here and we'll get the gang together. But we are so excited to talk to you. First off, well, we have a lot of things to talk about, but I want to talk about you being like a young phenom, playing in the US Open at 14 years old. I could barely break 100 when I was 14. Like, I can't even fathom playing in that golf tournament. Like, what was that experience like? Did you go into the qualifier thinking that you were going to qualify for the US Open, or was it like, oh my God, I qualified?
So crazy part of that story is that I don't consider myself a young phenom, because I think I just did random things when I was young. Mm-hmm. I didn't sign myself up for the US Open qualifier. My brother signed me up. I actually didn't know what I was qualifying for. And after I qualified, they said, how does it feel playing in the US Open? And I actually didn't know what the US Open was because I wasn't raised with golf. I just picked up golf a year ago and I practiced with my brother and he said, go qualify here.
You picked up golf a year before qualifying for the US Open?
It was in July and my birthday's in October. So it was almost when I was 13. It was about a year and a half that I've played golf and he said, go play this qualifier. And I just went and played. I had no idea what it was for and I made it. And then you had to go to sectionals back in the day. And then I made that. And then they said, how does it feel? And then I went, I don't know what this is for.
I don't know what this is for.
I just played because they told me to play. That was about it. And so I don't think I actually ever experienced the magnitude of the US Open.
Right. Right. And it probably worked in your favor, though, because you're just kind of like, hey, I'm here to tee it up and, you know, whatever happens, happens.
Yes. I had a great time.
Yeah.
I back in the day, all I knew was Annika Sorenstam. Like I said, I wasn't raised with golf, so don't judge me too much there. All I knew was Annika and Tiger.
Annika and Tiger. Those are, you know, those are pretty big names.
Yeah.
Those are good ones. Those are good ones to know.
Annika to this day that I signed up to play with her on Wednesday and she didn't play. So now that I'm a pro, we don't play all the times we sign up on, right? We switch around. And that was the year that she declared she was retiring. So only tournament I can probably play with her was the US Open. And I went, wait, I don't get to play with her. That was the only devastation that I experienced it. But I got to play with her for the first time in my entire life this year.
Wow.
So that was pretty cool.
What was that like?
I was actually nervous.
Really?
I was really nervous. Yeah, and I don't get nervous. I was on the tee, she was watching me. I go, I'm really nervous, Annika. She goes, hit the ball. So it's pretty fun.
That's amazing. That's really cool. Have you been able to, you know, you said you haven't played with Annika until this year, but have you been able to pick her brain at all over the last of your
yes,
career?
Yes, definitely. She's helped me out way more than she even knows. I do pick her brain a lot anytime, whether it's personal or in professional. I sometimes just give her a call and say, can I talk to you for a second? And she just calls me and we have a really nice chat.
That's a pretty nice phone number to have.
It is.
To ring up.
I get really excited every time she texts me. I go, it's Annika Sorenstam. Oh my fangirl every time.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's amazing. So you played in the US Open at such a young age, and then you won the US Amateur and then played in all four majors as an amateur. And I know you say you don't get nervous. Were you not nervous then?
No.
Wow.
I wasn't nervous then. I was nervous when I was trying to make a putt to win a TV off my dad. Like, it was things like that. Golf never gave me, I mean, I liked golf. I didn't love it. There was a difference. I was good at it. There was definitely bigger phenoms in junior golf. I didn't win junior tournaments. I didn't win AGGA events. I just kind of come and go mm-hmm. as I pleased. And it wasn't a career that I was striving for. But then next thing you know, when you make birdies and you win, you kind of catch the bug and you want to do better. And then you go to the next level and it's the collegiate golf. Then it's the pros.
So you loved that more so than the actual game
I loved
itself.
The competition, yes.
The competition.
The game, I learned to love it later. Mm-hmm. I was good at it, which made me like it. And then I probably learned to really love golf in the last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How have you been able to do that?
I guess time and life. And I felt that sometimes golf was taking things away from me, but then I realized that it's given me so many opportunities and I get to do something so cool and play golf for a living
for a living now,
right?
Yeah.
And I always think about the future, but it hasn't happened yet. And I don't know what I'm going to be when I grow up or when I'm done with golf, grow up. 28.
Same. I'm the same.
Yes.
Though.
And, but for now I'm good at something that I do. I make good income. I get to travel the world. I mean, I try to look at the positives and I really like getting better. And I think working with Butch has really helped me want to excel myself in the game on and off the golf course. And that's just the fun of it now.
Yeah. I think you kind of remind me, or that mindset reminds me a lot. We had Brooks Koepka and Jenna Sims on the pod, which was really fun. And Brooks, similar to you, I think, you know, is just in love with the process and in love with the competitiveness of it. And it's so interesting because some professional golfers are just obsessed with golf. Like Brooks referenced his dad and he said, like, my dad is a passionate golfer. Like he's out on the weekends. Like that's all he does. But he's like, for me, it's my job and I love the process.
Yes.
And I'm so grateful that I'm good at it. But it's the competitiveness.
That's exactly how I feel.
Yeah.
And the competitiveness sometimes it overrides yourself because you're in competition with yourself and you kind of tire yourself out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you just kind of get burnt out and go, oh, I just want to take a break because you're so tired of fighting yourself. That's the only thing I feel. But other than that, yeah, I talked to Keely, you know, Keely, and I said to her, I actually don't play golf recreationally. I don't just go out and have fun and play golf. It's not fun. Yeah. It's fun to play good. Let's be honest. I don't know why it's so fun to play bad. It's not. I work hard. I don't want to play bad. And anytime I tee it up, it has to be a game. Yeah. Or if it's not, then I'll make a new game for myself. I'll take clubs out and play with 5 clubs or 8 clubs. Or I have to do something to achieve something. Or
same. I never really understood people are out there that don't keep score or don't at least play some sort of game. I'm like, why are we out here?
Because they enjoy it. They love
the game. Because they love the game.
No. Yeah. I love the process and the competition. I don't love just going to play out there on Saturday.
Right. You're not
going to unless it's a tournament.
In Vegas, 107-degree heat. Just, this
I'm not out there 110 for no reason.
Yeah, exactly. You're trying to get better and trying to win.
Yeah.
So you talked about never being nervous, but I know that you have been pretty open about dealing with anxiety, which I admire so much. I think is so important as somebody that deals with mental health issues themselves. I think it's so important for people with a platform to be outspoken and just make it visible and like, hey, it's okay. So thank you for doing that. But at what time in your life did you sort of realize that you dealt with this?
Well, that's a deeper conversation, but I guess for me, anxiety is different than nerves. For me, nerves is, you know, fear of failure, right? And I'm okay with failing because I've tried, right? But anxiety is more so when things are not in my control. And I was more open about that because I didn't like the way I felt. I haven't liked the way I felt for a long time. And I actually felt that before I worked with Butch, I wasn't open about it. I felt that, you know, I worked with your dad as well and with David. And during then, I didn't know why I was feeling the way I was feeling. It had nothing to do with golf. And no matter how good the techniques were, how I felt wasn't going to help me perform. Mm-hmm. Being open about it helped. I think that sometimes we oversight what physical and mental pain can be because it does exist. Just because if we get a cut, it'll bleed. But if we get a cut internally, we can't see it. So I don't think it's fake. It's all real for everybody, whatever they're going through. I've always been told that, you know, try and put yourself in their shoes and, you know, they're going through something. And I kind of want people to understand that it's not just athletes either. It's everybody. Somebody's going through something and their issues are real to them, which makes it real. So try and understand. But taking care of yourself is an important issue. And for me, I think that's something that you can't really fix. Yeah. I don't think people can fix it. I think you can learn to deal with it.
100%. 100%.
It's okay to just look for help.
Yeah.
And there is help out there, but I think it's not a norm to have a therapist.
No.
It's not a norm to have a sport. Oh, it's normal to have an athlete to have a sports psych, but just daily life, like you do need someone to talk to that sometimes are not your friends that are not biased. And
yes,
I've actually, I mean, I don't think I've ever shared this, but I've had a therapist since I was 12.
So have I.
My parents thought that it'd be good for me to have somebody to talk to. So I've worked with the same therapist for 16 years of my life. But there's more in below that, right? There's therapists and then there's anxiety and you got to figure yourself out.
Yeah.
And it's a process. It's a never ending process and it's exhausting.
I think to your point too about like, and I've had the same conversation with my therapist. Like, you have anxiety. It doesn't mean that you're broken. Like, this is just something that you have. You're going to have good days and bad days. Mm-hmm. And kind of when you accept that it's not going to go away, like, it's just there. And you're going to be okay. And you learn, like, techniques to deal
with
it.
Yes, that's exactly. Some days will be peaceful. Some days you're not peaceful.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, God.
But you don't want to feel. I think it's really rough when, I think it's rough when you feel helpless.
Yes.
And I always want to, why I was open about it is that, you know, we all sometimes do feel helpless and it's okay.
Yes. I get anxiety about getting anxiety.
Yeah, it's like the anger when you're mad that you're mad, mad that you're mad.
Yeah. That's like, I feel like my panic come on, and then I panic that I'm panicking.
You can't stop.
And then I'm like, oh my God.
But then you have to like do all your techniques to like somehow.
Yeah, I'm like deep breathing.
Bring you back to present. Like it's all chill.
Exactly, exactly. I'm like slapping myself. I'm like, what do I feel? What do I smell? Yeah. What do I hear? But does it ever manifest itself on the golf course, or is it more?
Oh, all the time.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, it's just part of who you are. It doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. I think I was able to deal with it better when I was younger. Mm-hmm. I didn't know any better, right? We always call that the fearless courage that the younger kids have, is that we don't know as much. So mm-hmm. when I'm on the golf course, I used to be able to block everything out. Like that rope was like my invisible shield. And you know, sometimes the shield goes down, and I experienced it. I kind of freaked out, I panicked, and I go, oh, I just want to play golf. I don't like things bothering me. But you know what I learned, Hallie, is that things are gonna bother you. It's gonna have to just deal with it.
Yeah, yeah. Because the golf course, especially for someone that suffers from anxiety, golf course is a very quiet place.
That's my safe place. But really? Then it's not my safe place from my mind.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. Because people not necessarily gonna talk to you, but I'm out there in between shots, or I was, and I'd be like, please just shut up. Like, I just like try to sing a song or do something.
Because you have a lot of time.
Lost so much time.
You have too much time. That's why I carry a book. I read when there's too much time, when there's slow play. I gotta just keep my mind occupied.
Right. Yeah. Don't let it go. Just keep it on track.
Do something. Yeah. And then you have to learn to focus back in and zone out. That's just part of golf.
Yeah. So let's switch gears here for a minute. I know this relationship has been well documented, but I want to touch on it a little bit. You're very close with the Gretzkys.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
I love them.
You love them. And how did you guys link up?
We grew up together.
Okay.
Since we were kids. My brother was friends with Ty. First, I gotta say that he was friends with Ty first, and then after that we met Janet, Wayne. Then Janet and Wayne took me out to play at Sherwood all the time. I was a kid, and then next thing you know, I'm pretty sure I charged so much stuff to Wayne's account when we were kids. I mean, he really took care of me at Sherwood, and he actually got me my own membership, on my honorary membership when I turned pro. It just went from there. I knew Trevor growing up. He didn't used to talk very much when he was younger, but now he's a little bit more outgoing. Yeah. And they're like my brothers. And Tristan and Emma, I've seen them since they were. I told Emma the other day that I used to take her to Sky Jump. Is that what it's called? The trampoline place?
Oh, yeah.
And she was super young, and now she's all grown up. And I go, she's taller than me. I go, oh, man.
Remember when I used to take you bounce on the trampoline?
Yes. Oh, Tristan used to have blonde hair. It's just, I love that family. They've just been so great, and they've looked out for us, and not just for me, just for my whole family. They've been there. They're just like my second family. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is a good piece of advice that the great one has given you?
Wayne actually has given me a lot of advice. Recently, I think one of the advice that Wayne gave me, I'm trying to achieve, and that's going to take time. I think he told me something, and he said, I think this would help. This was his point of view on how to be more mindful or more into the game. Because he is one of the greatest of all times.
Yeah.
And I asked him on why he, you know, used to trace the puck. And I don't know if you know that. He used to have a pad, and he wouldn't take the pen off the pad. And he used to trace the puck the entire game. And I asked him why he did that, and he would explain. And
Why did he do that?
You know what? There's masterclass on it. You should watch it. Like that's, it's pretty cool.
Okay, cool. Yes. I'll watch that. Yeah, I'll pay for that.
It's I'll send you a guest pass.
Okay. Oh, yes. Perfect. Thank you so much.
Sorry, masterclass, but I pay for a subscription. So, but yeah, it's just you have to sometimes listen to what people say and great people that are in your life, and mm-hmm. take that with a grain of salt. And you sit there and you think about how you can get better. And Wayne's advice was actually very helpful. I don't think he even knows. I didn't tell him how helpful it was, but it's going to take time for me to achieve that part of a skill. And I think that is something that I'm really lacking in. So okay. It was really cool that he pointed something out without meaning to point it out.
That makes any sense. Yeah, no, that's awesome. That's, I mean, what an incredible you know, tool to have in your toolbox, Wayne Gretzky. So let's talk a little bit about Vegas. We're sitting here in Las Vegas, where you live now. Do you like to go out? Like, what's your Vegas situation? Like, I feel like if you live in Vegas, you have to go out, right?
So,
I mean, this is the best place in the world to go out.
Yes. So I don't go out very often.
Okay.
I hardly ever go out.
Okay.
But when I do go out. So
when I do,
I do go out. I and do. So what happens is, like, I have friends, my brother lives here. I got friends and family here. For me, that's when the anxiety kicks in and I would go out if I had time. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to be home for a week and then just go out, because I like to sleep. So if I pull an all-nighter, or we come home at 4 a.m. or nightclubs, I mean, I'm not lying here. You go out at midnight, right?
Yeah.
And then you eat at like 4 or 5 a.m. because that's what you do. So my entire next couple days is not my normal routine.
Right.
And I'm a very routine, organized person. So then I have to really put that into consideration.
Yeah, you're not going to be on the practice tee at 9 a.m. the next morning after your all-nighter.
So when it makes sense, I do go out. I do like to go out. I like the nightclubs because it's loud and you can't hear anything, and sometimes it just tunes you out.
Yeah. Back to our anxiety.
Yeah.
Can't hear your thoughts in a nightclub.
It's like, it's the crowd. Sometimes it's the crowd. And
yeah,
it comes and goes. Mm-hmm. But I do go out. I like to go to concerts and shows. My brother goes out. So I went out. You know what? I did go out recently. I went to one of the nightclubs, and one of our friend did a whole entire presentation for me for making the Olympics. She had just playing cards cut out of me come out, and it was during a Miley Cyrus concert. I'm going, what is happening?
Oh my God.
It was crazy.
Wait, so I'm sure like Miley Cyrus saw
it. No, she probably saw it from the side. She wasn't performing. My cutout was like not chanting at her when she was off the stage, because she was really close.
That's amazing. So let me just describe this for people that are listening. Danielle is like, you know, if people are listening, they go to nightclubs, sometimes you'll go and get a table. And then if it's your birthday or celebrating something, they'll come with like,
fireworks, like, or presentation.
Like fireworks or like sparklers.
Sparklers, and the girls come out.
And the girls come out in their little outfits.
And then you're like the king for like, yeah.
And give you your bottles of whatever. And they did that for Danielle because of the Olympics during a Miley Cyrus concert.
Almost every time I go out, they do something like that, because I never go out.
Just to celebrate just that Danielle is out at the club.
Like, they make a point. My brother makes a point that I came out.
And I love that.
I remember going to Hakkasan so many times, and they'll just put like Danielle King's in the house or something.
Yeah, they're like, looking what up, it I say? Go, it just says Danielle King is here, and they're like,
they'll
woo!
Say something like that. Like, it's just ridiculous. And then I'm in a hoodie and sweatpants.
Oh my God.
Because I don't like to dress up. Like, tonight,
is Hakkasan,
I like
to, is that an MGM
yes,
club?
Yes. It's at MGM.
Oh my brand. God. If I was sponsored by MGM, I would totally go to their clubs in my sweatpants.
It's a stylish hoodie.
It's a stylish hoodie.
I look absolutely homeless, but it's a stylish hoodie.
Okay.
So
stylish,
I'm never in
person.
Heels. Like, sometimes I dress up when it's an occasion, right?
Okay.
Like,
yeah,
bachelor
yeah.
parties or whatever. Uh-huh. But yeah, I go there, I'm sitting there, all of a sudden this presentation comes out, girls come out with the bottles, and I go, oh my God, Alex. Or I'm like, David, stop it. They love it. They love doing stuff
that
like that.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
That is amazing. That is the
Vegas is fun.
Vegas is fun. And especially when you have the hookup at MGM, it is even more fun.
Yes.
All right. So before I let you go, I want to ask you one question. Back to golf. What is one thing that you would change about golf if you could?
Just one?
Okay. What are two things that you could change about golf if you could?
I actually talked about this. Do I have to make this brief, or can I just go on a rant really quick?
Rant away.
I like to explain myself is because I'm a traditionalist, and yet I'm not. I'm a hypocrite. I'm an actual hypocrite in golf. I think that golf should be traditional, yet I don't dress traditionally. I know that I look, sometimes some people call it sloppy. I wear joggers, hoodies, leggings. I do think that it needs to progress, because that's, for me, in my idea, that's how we can grow women's golf.
Totally.
Is when women could feel comfortable. We wear leggings everywhere. Why not to the golf course? And I told them to make a pocket that fits the yardage book. So, like, now it's sports, right? As long as it's not disrespectful to golf, it doesn't matter. Recreational golfers, I think they should be able to wear whatever they want. Public golf courses, you want to wear a bikini? Go right ahead. Who cares, right? Private golf courses, we got to respect. There's there are the rules. Now, golf comes with the traditional etiquette. You have to learn the rules. I don't agree with the changing rules of the yardage guns to greens books to, it's just taking the traditional part skill set of the game away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now you can ground your club in hazards. I mean, but why? Mm-hmm. Well, what is that doing? Like, the whole point of it is to, for you not to ground the club. That does make a difference. Now, for, I just think that there should be two different sets of rules for recreational golfers and
that's fair.
And professional golfers.
That's fair. I wouldn't say you're a hypocrite. You just have, like, maybe, you know, generally people would assume that you might be, like, super progressive in, like, all areas of the game. But there, I agree with you. There are some areas of the game that do need to be preserved, or else it's not golf anymore. It's something
else. It's, I mean, part of you being able to get yardages is part of golf.
It's a skill.
It's a skill. We have to have a caddy, right? And I say have to is because you don't play junior golf with caddy. You don't play college golf with caddies. We practice by ourselves. This is an individual sport. We're alone all the time. We fight with the golf ball all day for years. And then you turn pro and you have to have a caddy. So yes, I do use the word have to. Now I get to have a caddy. Let's change to get to. They have a skill. Some people are really good at getting numbers. Some people are really good at reading greens. But if you take those kind of skills away, now you bring in a yardage gun. Okay. What's the point?
Yeah.
Where do we draw a line is where my thing comes in. That's why I said, if I can change one thing in golf, I wish that golf could be separated between recreational golfers and professional golfers. Mm-hmm. Putting with the pin in, it doesn't, I understand. Yes, it does. It does, what do you call it? Make pace of play faster. Mm-hmm. For amateur golfers, we have to put the pin in. Some people want the pin out. How do you go from a two-shot penalty to no-shot penalty? Person wants in, and then the caddies have to run over, put the pin back in. It's just, it's enough. Like, yeah. We got to separate it. Golf, yes, it's slow. I get it. The pace of play is very slow. Mm-hmm. It's 18 holes. We have a routine. Each routine takes about 45 to 1 minute normally. Mm-hmm. People take minutes. Let's be honest. No one's fast. What is the difference between 5 hours and 15 minutes and 4 hours and 45? Mm-hmm. It's going to take 4 and 5 hours.
Yeah.
I don't care how you slice it, it's gonna take 5 hours. Now, if you want to cut the field in half, be my guest and make it twosome, be my guest. However, if we keep complaining about pace of play, then get rid of the holes. Like, make six, nine holes. Like, I don't care. Like, yeah. 6-hole matches, and all of a sudden, recreational golfers should understand it doesn't have to be full 18.
Yeah.
You could play full 18, you could just play 6 holes, you could mm-hmm. play par threes. Like, there isn't a rule, but I don't know how to, like, make a rule to be a little bit, a gap, because golf is the one sport where everyone feels they can all do it.
Yeah.
And that's fine. Mm-hmm. But if we really want to follow the rules, it's going to take time.
Yeah, that's
like,
fair.
You don't get to ground your club. Like, sometimes you have a lie and you're scared to even touch a blade of grass. It's going to take 30 seconds to kind of analyze the situation. Let's not criticize somebody for, hey, why is she taking so long? I don't know. Maybe she needs to make rent. I don't know. Maybe she needs to make rent, and there's an ant, and the ant's bothering her, and she doesn't want to miss a putt, and it's 3.5 feet. Who knows? But I don't get to criticize why people are slow.
Yeah, that's very fair. It's super easy for a 15 handicapper to criticize a pro golfer who's slow. Yeah,
I say play ready golf.
Yeah.
Ready golf is fine. Like, if you have a understanding, I think that etiquette maybe can change a little bit. Be like, hey, just whoever's ready, go. But at least be communicative. Hey, I'll go. So then people don't feel rude and people don't feel like they have to ask. That's fine. Like Brittany Lincecum. I don't think she'd care if I say this. When I play with her, she has an automatic honors with me. She is so fast. I don't care if I make birdie. I don't care if I'm 7 under. She is hitting. Because I don't need to rush. I don't walk as fast as her. She can go anytime she'd like.
Yeah.
But if that's the best golf she can play at that time, yeah, I like to take my time. Mm-hmm. But the slow play has been an issue that has been brought up a lot to me in a lot of interviews. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't really care that much.
Yeah. You were out there. That's our job.
Some people are not making rent here. Yeah. And they just lost $4,000 because hotel, car, caddy, coach. Like, if she needs to take 3 minutes on a shot, I mean, just let me know. Maybe I can just go to the green.
Get your book out.
Yeah, like, maybe I can just go. Like, let me go. Then take all the time you want.
Yeah.
Who cares? You know what I mean? Like, yeah, holding up pace of play. I mean, there's 144 players around. What do you want us to do?
Yeah.
It's going to take all day. Me yelling at you to hurry it up for 3 minutes is not going to change or make my life. I'm still going to eat dinner when I'm going to eat dinner.
Yeah.
It's like, whatever you're comfortable with, you know? Like,
I'm still going to make my 7:30 reservation.
Yeah, it's chill. Like, to me, that's how I feel. But being unaware that you're slow, and now it like makes it sensitive. And then they're like, I'm not slow. Like, why are you timing me? It's just like, it's stressful.
Yeah.
Why add stress?
No, that's a fair point. Very fair.
But anyways, that's my rant.
That was a great rant, Danielle. That was great.
So there's not just one thing I want to change.
No, there's many. And I think you make
it's just all an opinion.
Hey, we're all allowed to have our opinions. And I think those are very, very valid opinions. So
what do they say? Opinions are like assholes. Everybody has one. And it all stinks, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So like, I'm not saying my opinion is correct. I will put that on record. I just how I feel.
And you are very valid in that. I love that. Oh my God. That was amazing. All right, Danielle. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We'll have to get you back on soon. Yeah, we appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
Thanks.
I genuinely know I do always love hearing Danielle speak because she's just so fiery and passionate. And speaking of authenticity, as we did in our first episode, she is 100% authentically herself, which I really, really respect. What was your favorite part of that interview, Hallie?
Well, yes, very, very authentic. I think that I personally really connected with our conversation about mental health, kind of when we spoke at the beginning about how I'm just so in awe of how courageous she is in terms of just sharing that and how important visibility is when it comes to mental health. So people feel like they aren't alone and they aren't weird if they, you know, do struggle with it. So I think that was really great. And then I personally also just loved at the end. Well, I didn't really talk. I just kind of listened to her, like you said, passionate thoughts on slow play and how, you know, these girls are out there paying for their rent check. So, you know, kind of get off their backs and let them take the time that they need, which I thought was an interesting take because most players that I've spoken to up until this point have been, you know, very much, you don't play slow. Slow play is very distracting. And Danielle's point was like, hey, as long as you don't slow me down, I'll walk up the fairway. I'll hit first. I'll do whatever. If you need to take your time, it's fine. And I was like, huh. I didn't think about that, but you're right. If money's on the line, I can understand why you'd want to take as much time as you need.
Yeah, I guess I would argue that I think it almost kills viewership a bit because if something is so long and laborious and drawn out, you know, that's not fun to watch, right? Mm-hmm. And therefore, if it was quicker, maybe those rent checks would maybe not be higher. That's a very simplified way of saying it, but like, I'm not sure it helps raise those rent checks if you're taking your sweet time.
That's a good point. You know? That's a very good point. That's a
from a viewership entertainment point of view. From a playing point of view, I completely understand that because obviously been there, done that, wore that t-shirt, had $10 in my bank account, needed to take my sweet time to make sure I was lining up that putt correctly because I had to go in.
It had to go in. Yeah,
I definitely get both sides of the argument. If you're out there on the golf course, I'm not sure you're thinking about viewership really, if you're like fighting for your rent check. But then in the media space, I'm like, hang on. Yeah, I don't want to watch that.
I think what we can agree on regardless is that it's a completely different argument when it's not professional golf. When it's casual golf that you're playing for fun, you better hurry up. Yeah. Because I do not want a 5-hour round in carts.
Also, you're going to miss that 3-footer anyway. Just get it over.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know who said it. I think a golfer said, like, if you're going to hit a bad shot, hit it fast or something. And I thought that was pretty funny. Most of the time, people play better when they play quickly anyways. I mean, 100%. Monica, the GOAT, is such a fast player. And I remember, this is kind of embarrassing, but when I was in college, I was a very slow player. I was,
deliberate.
Yeah, deliberate. But I think, again, it came from a place of me, again, with my OCD, having to make sure everything was perfect. You know, right. Like,
I couldn't have like a hair out of place. I needed to feel good behind the ball. And maybe there was, if there was a leaf next to my ball, oh my God, could not hit it. Had to move it, you know, but it came. Yeah. I mean, but it was funny because once I, it's almost like when I took less time, there was less time for all of these thoughts. And my college golf coach, when I played at Arkansas, would, in qualifying, would give me a one shot penalty every single time I would go over like the 40 second limit. And I actually played so much better with this fear of this one shot penalty for playing slow. So, yeah. So it was, it's kind of like a funny thing because you take the time because you want to make sure everything's perfect. But when you're taking that time, you almost can like psych yourself out a little bit as well. So you're better up just standing up and hitting the shot.
Yeah. The thing is, all slow players know how to hit a shot within the time limit.
Mm.
And I'm not having anyone tell me that they don't. On the flip side, conversely, there has been, I've known two or three players in the past, couple at qualifying school and couple like just playing regularly, who will maintain their slow speed and take the penalties, take the shot penalties, take the financial penalties. And they're just like, I'll play better like this. So I'm going to take the penalties. And that's not going to impact my game as much as playing faster will.
Wow.
Yeah. That's a new level.
Must be very good then, because to be able to take the shot penalties.
Yeah. A mixed bag, but yeah, that's a thing as well. Back to Danielle, I know she recently came under some scrutiny at the Solheim Cup. People, you know, saying that her brash character, specifically within Solheim Cup, and some quotes that she made a while back saying, you know, what was it?
Oh, I want to take souls or something, right?
Right.
That I want
to
take
now
souls.
Come back to haunt her with. USA having lost the last two Solheim Cups. So what would you say to that now, having spoken to her and getting to know her a little bit more, and obviously her struggles with like mental health and being herself and coming up through the game as she did, like what's your sort of take on that now?
Yeah. I mean, I think she's just similar to our first or one of our first guests, Brooks, in that way that take her or leave her. If you don't like her, she doesn't care. And yeah. I think her being brash is fine. I mean, it was the Solheim Cup, you know, like give her a break. She's going to be.
Passionate. Oh, I agree. 100%.
And also take like, souls. Was that like a pun on Solheim Cup or was she, I was like, or does she,
I don't know, but either way, I feel like it, you know, said in a jokey way, like, is she actually wanting to reach?
She's not out there like physically like, trying to hurt anybody. She just wants to.
No, I feel like that's, team. You know, I feel like that's almost a you can't win scenario, isn't it? Because on the one hand, people are like, the Solheim Cup needs to be more passionate. And on the other hand, they're like, no, not that much passionate.
Yes. No, not too much. Passionate, but not like that.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think it just goes again back to, you know, you might as well just do what you want to do and what feels right for you and in your heart, because you can't please everyone. So I'm all for, again, like, you might not always agree with these players and their actions or what they say, but you have to respect their commitment to staying true to themselves.
Do you think if she was a man, she would have been as criticized for saying that?
No, probably not.
I agree. I would say not.
No. Cause it's if a guy said that about the Ryder Cup, people would be like, hell yeah. Take souls.
Yeah. Which brings me to my final point is, you know, love or hate Danielle Kang, I love seeing a strong, fearless woman doing what she does best and being incredibly successful at it. Let's not forget, she's a major champion. Like you said, if a men's major champion had said that at a Ryder Cup, I think it would have been celebrated.
Not for sure. Absolutely. I agree. Well, Henny, as always, a real pleasure. We hope you guys enjoyed listening, and we will see you in another 2 weeks.